50s.
Are you ready?
Friday, Friday, Friday. Get them out by Friday.
Friday night fever.
Yes, Friday. Woo!
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
Hey, looks like the Canadians are here.
866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on First Amendment Friday here in the Pacific Northwest. I got to tell you about an idea that is coming out of King County, Washington for a brand new law called the Stupid Motorist Law. Now, chances are the legislature will goof it up and call it something else, but I think it's a great idea. Let me get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to First Amendment Friday. Thank goodness we ended up with President Donald Trump, who actually values the God-given First Amendment freedoms of American citizens and didn't end up with Kamala Harris or some other Biden surrogate who was going to take those First Amendment freedoms away. After all, during the 4 years of Joe Biden, we saw plenty of examples where your First Amendment freedoms were impinged upon, and not only that, but where the government was literally spying on not just members of the U.S. Senate, members of the House, presidential candidates and the like, but was spying on American citizens as well. So we have our First Amendment freedoms. We celebrate them once a week on the Lars Larson Show. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you can vote in our X poll. After this week's big gambling bust involving NBA stars and the mafia, are NBA games to be trusted as real, or are they rigged for the betting crowd? I think there's a good reason to believe that. Chauncey Billups, who is now under indictment, he has not yet had his day in court. He has entered a not guilty plea. All of those are facts. But a separate indictment, separate from the main gambling indictment, says that, it doesn't name Billups, but it describes an NBA coach matching his description, passing along information about the Portland Trailblazers star players sitting out a game as the team began to tank for a top lottery pick in 2023. So, are the games fixed or not? Can fans actually trust the games or not? I'm asking you in this week's X poll. You can find the question every day at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. It's always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, in yesterday's X poll, I asked you whether Democrats are deliberately working to run America's poor out of food to foment violence when SNAP benefits end on November 1st, or more correctly stated, when the new benefits for November just fail to dispense. At this point, there's no indication the Democrats are going to give up their jihad to keep the government shut down. If the government is still shut down when November 1 rolls around, then the SNAP benefits are going to be either severely restricted or they're not going to be there at all. And I've got a couple of thoughts on that a bit later on. But how did you vote? Are Democrats working to run America's poor out of food? 94% of you agreed with me and said yes. Only 6% of you said no. Now, about this idea, and it comes from my only favorite member of the King County Council, and that is Reagan Dunn. Reagan Dunn shot off a letter to Governor Bob Ferguson and his Washington Department of Transportation. And why did he do that? Because there had been a series of crashes involving vehicles and bridges. And what Dunn says is he wants a state law that actually holds anybody on the roads, motorists, truck drivers, that sort of thing, accountable for incidents like that. Dunn calls it the Stupid Motorist Law. And I think it's a great idea. Here's what he told King 5 News. He said, "This isn't just another car accident," talking about the most recent incident. "We've got to stop treating it like another car accident. It's a serious economic harm and a harm to taxpayers. If we don't put something like this in place, it's going to keep happening." So, just a reminder, back in August, the White River Bridge, which had just reopened recently, was severely damaged. And why? because a semi-truck crashed into the structure. And then on Tuesday of this week, the Bullfrog Road Bridge over I-90 near Cle Elum, it got damaged as well. Governor Ferguson, of course, did what Democrats usually do. He issued an emergency proclamation. All that did was allow crews to begin demolition. So I guess that's a good thing. Kind of weak sauce, if you ask me. But Dunn said the governor is clearly frustrated. He worked so hard to get the White River Bridge up, and then this dum-dum runs into the Bullfrog Road Bridge. Dunn says that these incidents can cost up to $10 million to repair, in addition to lost work hours by employees stuck in traffic, disruption to emergency services, and lost income for businesses near the work zones and closures, all of that reported by King 5. He says it's not just about an operator or a driver making a stupid choice. It is the damage created, the economic damage that's done by the closure of those bridges. And, you know, one of the things this raises that I've never actually had a satisfactory answer to, if you have a $10 million repair and the company that owns the truck has insurance, does most of that damage get paid for by the insurance carried by the driver or carried by the owner of that truck? I have this sneaking suspicion that limitations on their liability probably mean that they get the insurance policies to pay out the maximum, and I'd be willing to bet it doesn't begin to repair all the damage. Now, if I'm wrong about that, I'll be happy to stand corrected. But do you think when you hear these things happen, and then you see the millions of dollars collectively as people have to divert, freight is diverted, all these other changes happen, it hurts a lot of people in ways that probably will never get compensated. If a bridge goes out and then you have to drive an extra 50 or 100 miles to get to your job or to deliver things, does that money get paid back? And when the state loses millions of dollars having to repair one of those, does the state just suck up the damage? I would hope that any governor of any state of any political party would come out and tell the public either it cost this much to repair, we got all of it paid by the insurance from the people who did the damage. If that's the case, then tell the public. If instead, well, we got a few million bucks, there was a negotiated settlement, and the taxpayers have to eat the rest of it, then that should be communicated to the public. But one way or another, if you just assume that that's what's going to happen, I've had too many cases where mistakes were made, not just bridge accidents like this, but where a company makes a big mistake. And then an entire overpass has to be rebuilt in some cases, and there are plenty of those. And then you find out, yeah, the taxpayers are on the hook. And you say, hold on, if somebody does a bad repair at your house and they goof it up, they either come back and set it right or they pay you what it costs to set it right. Does the state take the same kind of attitude, or does it just say, hey, it's the taxpayers' money? Who cares? Somebody else can pay the bill. I'd like to know. And I would think it'd be the kind of thing that any politician would want to tell to taxpayers. Hey, a bunch of damage was done here. We went after the people who caused the damage. We got every single cent of it paid for. If that's the case, then tell the public that. If you missed and it can't, if the insurance settlement fell short of paying the bill, you know who gets the bill instead? That would be the taxpayers of whatever area that was in. Anyway, it's First Amendment Friday, live on the Radio Northwest Network, and always glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers go first. Coming up in a moment, Multnomah County is whining about SNAP benefits, and they're saying it's the president's fault. I'm going to tell you how Multnomah County could fix that problem right now.
Constantine Kissin on Hamas.
For years now, many of us have been warning that the barbarians are at the gates. We were wrong. They're inside. There are positives as well. I mean, say what you want about Hamas supporters. At least they know what a woman is.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Multnomah County leadership blames the federal government, meaning, translation, that evil President Donald Trump, for cutting off food stamps to poor residents. No, it's not Trump. It's just a few Democrat senators who voted to shut down the federal government, including Democrat senators Jeff Merkley and Ron Wyden. Well, Democrat County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson put it this way. It is unconscionable for the federal government to shut off this critical resource. We need action now. Bull feathers. Dear Jessica, the government you head, Multnomah County, runs the food stamp program that spends about $6 million in federal money every month to provide SNAP for 143,000 people. That means Multnomah County administers the program. You also run a county with a $4 billion budget. We all know this shutdown will end in weeks at most. The longest one ever in American history was 35 days. This one already ranks as the second longest shutdown of the federal government. So, dear Jessica, if you need action now, pony up $6 million out of your $4 billion budget to pay the November benefits now. Then when the Democrats end their shutdown jihad, as we're sure they're going to, in just a few weeks, the county gets its cash back. Unless, dear Jessica, you are celebrating the shutdown, like Senator Chuck Schumer, also a Democrat, who declared about the shutdown, it gets better every day. And you think angry, hungry people play to the Democrat Party's advantage. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. It is First Amendment Friday, after all. You can also send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Would children benefit if we brought this all-American slogan back to classrooms? Well, public schools in Caldwell, Idaho, will soon be featuring signs with the national motto of the United States of America, In God We Trust. Per a new state law that was passed 2 years ago, public school schools and colleges and universities must display signs with the national motto on them if they have received public money. Now, with the new Idaho state law, we saw an opportunity to give children a reminder that the Creator is always with them. Our donation helps remind students that we are a free people, free to express our faith in the Creator, regardless of where you are, even at school. I think it's a terrific idea. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to award today's Daily Grill at the suggestion of Oregon Catalyst and the Taxpayers Association. Last night, Governor Kotek and her staff began her trip to Japan and South Korea, which is going to cost taxpayers $200,000. They point out this trip will likely be much her much-hyped 36-county tour of Oregon, where she toured every county in Oregon on a big listening tour, but provided no actual lessons or accomplishments from the trip. Kotek wants to promote travel and business to Oregon. If so, Kotek should help the federal government stop the 120 days of riots happening at the Portland Ice Building, and Governor Kotek should help business by vetoing the $4.3 billion gas tax bill. The trip comes only weeks after Kotek herself announced the state government employee travel freeze, which apparently she and her mentally ill spouse are not subject to. And in King County, I want to give them a grill today. King County's jail hired 100 non-citizens to work in the jail. Somebody better explain that, and I don't think the explanation is going to wash. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes. I hired them to do it for me, and it's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Lars, just so you know, I had to send Oregon Democrats in the legislature a note, writes Mark. That party is evil and the public is watching. Seems that for a month, it was just fine to hold 500 ODOT workers hostage for a new tax. In the end, you truly didn't need to pass in a straight party line. Now, the SNAP community is being held hostage in political games. In my opinion, Oregon should be a standalone state, not the debtor state dependent on all others to subsidize. Will SNAP-eligible people get back their subsidies when the D.C. Democrats finally pass the funding bill? My guess is public sector union employees will be paid for services not rendered. Shame on you. Sign Mark. To your calls now, and let's start Friday the way we should always with a naysayer. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. We love naysayers. So what do you and I disagree about that makes you one?
Well, Lars, I agree with most of what you say, but I think we should look at who is approving these 15-foot bridges that works for the Washington State Department of Transportation. Why are they building bridges that don't accommodate our vehicles?
Well, they do accommodate them, but you have to know it is incumbent, could we agree that every single CDL driver, even a non-CDL driver, has to know the height limits on the highways? And generally, I figure under 14 feet is the maximum height, unless you have an oversized load, in which case it's a whole different matter. You get permits for that. If you've got something that's wider or taller than the freeway will accommodate, and you have to take every off-ramp and then get back on the freeway on the other side, isn't that the job of the driver? You know what the heights are, right?
Well, I agree. Assuming this, was this an oversized load? Because 15 feet seems pretty close to
I don't
the minimum
think it was
anyway.
An oversized. My understanding is it wasn't. And oftentimes, in fact, I've seen bridges hit in the last 6 months where it was because somebody left a dump truck dump bed up instead of down, and it was taller than it should be. But that's the job of the CDL driver to make sure, to say, I know how high the load is, I know I'm under the legal minimums, and if I know there are some low overpasses or bridges, then I have to accommodate that. There are a few places, and most of those bridges or tunnels are very well signed. They'll even, in some cases, they'll even sign that at one side of a tunnel, for example, it's 11 feet. So the bigger trucks have to go down the center line to be able to make it through. But how big would you like the bridge to be if 15 or 14 feet is not enough?
Well, I don't know the exact height of a typical truck, but if this wasn't an oversized
typically it's
truck
less than 14
anyway,
feet, and if I'm wrong on that,
$10 million
Jeff,
to build. If we're spending $10 million to build it in the first place, why don't we just make it big enough to accommodate almost all trucks? And
well,
then they don't have to do all
that. I'm sure that if you go to a bridge engineer, I'm not one, but if you said, instead of making it 15 feet, we've got a lot of dummies out there, let's make them all 20 feet tall. I'm sure it costs more money. It takes more engineering. There may even be some changes in how long the bridge has to be if it's going to be that much taller. There's a reason they standardize the height, and then most of the people who haul on the highways standardize the height of their rigs. But, you know, I've seen bridges hit because somebody leaves a piece of equipment like a forklift or a front-end loader, and they leave it with the bucket up, and the bucket takes the truck past the allowable height.
I don't disagree with negligence, but if you've got a typical-sized vehicle and you're hitting bridges, it shouldn't cost that much more, and I'm not talking making it 5 feet tall, but make it tall enough that you don't have to route these big trucks through neighborhoods and other places.
I think they're in neighborhoods because they won't build freeway.
The Lars Larson Show. Knew better, do you?
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm sure you heard our X-Poll, and the X-Poll had to do with today's question. And the question is whether or not after this week's big gambling bust, do you trust that NBA games are real or are they rigged for the betting crowd? Because they not only busted some NBA stars or former stars, including some current stars, but they busted them for taking part in fixed poker games where the bad guys were at the table. The bad guys were in the back room as well, and they were able to read the cards on the table. And they were apparently using the NBA players, either one of the coaches is accused, Chauncey Billups, and then some players and former players. They were called the face cards, meaning they were the draw to get the fish to the table. And the fish at the table was the guy who's there to lose money, although he didn't know it until the end of the game. And they said it involved all the big crime families, Gambino, Bonanno, Genovese, Lucchese. They're all involved, allegedly. They have a chance to have their day in court. But there was another allegation, and that was the second indictment involved Chauncey Billups, the Portland Trailblazers coach, now on leave from his job, who was accused of letting bettors know, some of the bettors know, that one of the games was probably going to be tanked. And in that case, I think the NBA has to earn back some respect and maybe trust from the fans of the game. So I thought we'd check in with Zach Jensen, who is content developer at the Mob Museum. Zach, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, tell my audience, first of all, what the Mob Museum is. It's down in Vegas. I think I've gone once, but it's quite an interesting collection of things. And obviously, what better place to put it than Las Vegas?
Yeah, we're the Mob Museum, the National Museum of Organized Crime and Law Enforcement. And we're in downtown Las Vegas. And what we do is we try to tell a balanced history of organized crime, highlighting both the bad guys and the good guys, because you can't tell one story without telling the other.
Now, by the good guys, do you mean the Untouchables, or were there good organized crime figures involved in the illegal side of the business?
Oh, no. I'm talking about law enforcement on the good side.
That's a good idea. So are you going to have to open up a whole new exhibit after this week's bust?
You know, I kind of want to get my hands on one of those shuffler machines.
Oh, the ones where you put in several or a deck of cards or a couple of decks of cards and the machine actually reads the cards so it can tell you where the aces and the face cards are?
Exactly. Wouldn't that make a great centerpiece for an exhibit on this topic?
I think even better is to have one of the, what do they call them, the tables, the X-ray poker tables. I didn't even know there was such a thing, but they call them X-ray. I don't know if they actually use X-rays or if you have to worry about radiation when you're sitting at a poker table, but apparently they can read the cards when the cards are face down on the table as they usually are during a poker game.
Absolutely. We got to get our hands on one of those.
So would you mind telling my audience what they'd see if they came to the Mob Museum?
So you're going to see a history of organized crime in America and beyond. You know, we'll take you through what you know as the mob, you know, the Italian-American organized crime along with Jewish Americans and Irish Americans. You know, that these guys got started back during Prohibition, which is the best thing that happened to the mob. And they got a lot of money, and you'll see how they evolved over time, even coming to Las Vegas, and ultimately how they were taken down.
And by the way, I'm glad you mentioned, because it sounds like both the mob and gambling and organized crime actually had diversity before the Democrats ever dreamed it up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All colors working with the mob.
All colors and as you said, Italian, which everybody, I think, could identify, and then Irish and Jewish as well. So how did this all come together? Who decided to make a museum to the mob?
Well, our mayor at the time was Oscar Goodman. He was
him.
A former mob attorney.
Yep.
And, you know, City Hall is right next to the Mob Museum, and he could see the building. This is an old federal courthouse built in 1933. By the 2000s, the federal government was done with this building, and so Mayor Goodman was looking for a new purpose. And what better way than to have a mob museum that not just doesn't just go into the history of organized crime in Las Vegas, but the whole nation and the world.
So tell me this. Does that mean that you're in a building where there were actually people convicted of organized crime, criminal activity in the building where the Mob Museum is now located?
Yes, there were historic events that happened in our building, including a high-profile Senate hearing in 1950 called the Heapover Hearings. So mobsters testified in our courtroom.
Wow. It sounds fascinating. So what is this going to – this bust this week does not sound like it's anything dramatic or new from the usual activities of both gambling and organized crime.
That's correct. You know, gambling is nothing new for the mob. It's age old, and this case is a little bit different because – yes, this is gambling, but at the end of the day, it's a scam, which is another one of the mob's favorite things to do to make money. And so the fact that we see this cutting-edge technology along with these high-profile names, and the fact that, you know, if you're a casino, if you're running a gambling ring, it's not good business to cheat your customers because they'll find someplace else to gamble.
No, in fact, aren't the local casinos in Vegas pretty intolerant of people cheating? I mean, especially when they take from the house, but they run a pretty tight ship down on the Strip, don't they?
They sure do. In fact, we have the Black Book, And if you're caught cheating, you'll probably make your way in that book and never be welcome again in a Nevada casino.
Now, hold on. Is that names and ages and monikers and pictures as well, so they know who all the cheaters are and they just put them in the book and you're 86 from any club?
Oh, yeah. Your picture, your name, all your nicknames, all your information is in that book.
Wow.
So we know who you are.
How many people in the book? You know,
there's dozens of people in that book, and it's been going strong since 1960.
Wow. Okay. Well, it sounds like this is going to provide you a new opportunity to maybe open up a new wing of the Mob Museum. How big is the museum right now? I mean, does it occupy the entire courthouse?
Oh, yeah. We make use of every inch of that building, you know, where we have four floors full of mob history.
Did you preserve any of the old courtrooms? The ones that had maybe the more notorious cases?
Absolutely. We've actually restored the courtroom to the way it looked in 1950. And so when you come into our courtroom, you're stepping back into history.
Wow. So maybe you can get Chauncey Billups to come down and do after he's done with all his legal troubles and whatever time he might have to spend in the Gray Bar Hotel, maybe he can come down and do an event at the Mob Museum. He might need the money by then.
Hey, he won't be the first former criminal to be on our stage.
Do you have people who are the former criminals show up there? I mean, has Pete Rose ever come by?
No, we have plenty of former criminals who, many of them have gone public witness. In fact, almost every day we have a former Chicago mobster, Frank Calabrese Jr., telling his story to our guests.
He sits there and does story time?
Yes, he does.
Now, what's that like? How old is he now?
So, Frank is not a young man anymore, but his stories are fascinating. He tells, his story of growing up in the mob with his father and how ultimately they both went to prison in the same prison, and he decided to join Team America and wear a wire to put his father away.
So he got to be part of the family business. Zach, thanks very much. I appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
That is Zach Jensen, who is the content developer for the Mob Museum, located where else? Las Vegas, Nevada. It is First Amendment Friday. We'll get back to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And, of course, you can always vote in our poll on X. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarsen.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars has welcomed naysayers for 27 years, but occasionally...
Who is this person who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network. A couple of things to mention. Number one, Capitol rumors that there may be a couple of gubernatorial candidates who are going to throw their hat in the ring at some point. One of them, of course, Christine Drazen. We expect her to run for governor again. But also rumored, former Portland Trailblazer star Chris Dudley ran for Oregon governor 15 years ago in 2010, lost to John Kitzhaber, which I found especially painful because Kitzhaber then let his girlfriend treat the governor's office like a pay-for-play ATM. So when he ran again and won in 2014, he then had to resign in 2015, a month after inauguration. Dudley only lost by about 22,000 votes, which means that a Republican can win even in a cheating situation like vote by mail. To your calls now on this First Amendment Friday, let me go first to a naysayer. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, not so much the idea, but the way to get there. First of all, I wanted to comment about beef prices, but I wanted to say as far as the bridge thing, if you've got foreign drivers, you better have those heights and meters, too, and the roads signs in kilometers. Well, anyways, as far
because the truck drivers are required to understand how to speak, read, and write English, and if they can't, they shouldn't be on the road at all.
Okay.
Right?
Well, okay. Getting to the idea of beef prices. Now,
yeah.
I've worked on a cattle ranch. Have you ever done that?
No, I mean, I've been to cattle ranches. I have friends who are ranchers.
Hey, the biggest cost to ranchers is the price of diesel, and I think it needs to be dropped at least $2 a gallon in Oregon and Washington, maybe $1 a gallon in some of the other states.
Well, dropped how?
Well, I think we need to have a Manhattan Project for the manufacture of refineries, and they're going to have to be built by government and leased to the oil companies.
What? John, you're going to have the people who run Amtrak and the post office build refineries? Anything complicated at all?
Can you imagine a bigger disaster? Do a better job. Because we need refined.
Can you tell me anything the government can build competently, John?
Do you know how much product oil products are needed even to manufacture the COVID?
Okay, now you're changing the subject. You want to have the government build refineries? I think that sounds absolutely insane. But we'll throw it out there for folks. Let's go to Dwight in Mount Vernon. Hey, Dwight, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KVI. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I'm a retired commercial driver, and at one time I was a certified oversized load pilot.
Yeah.
And regarding the bridges, the state puts out what's called the bridge book,
yep.
And it lists every single bridge clearance in the state. So
that's assuming you can read English, right?
Well, assuming, yeah.
Well, you remember that Oregon and Washington are sanctuary states. We have lots of illegal alien drivers. The estimate in California is 62,000 illegals with CDLs, so kind of scary.
Oh, it's criminal what's going on there. But on these bridge accidents, 14 feet is the legal maximum height without an oversized permit. You can get permitted up to 14'6", and you don't need a lead pilot. Anything over 14'6". You have to have a lead pilot with what they call a high pole.
Yep.
And that the load behind will know that the bridge is too low if that high pole hits the bridge. But it's the responsibility of the lead pilot to run the route that you're going to take with that oversized load. And he goes to the bridge book and finds out what the heights are on the entire route that yep. they are going to follow.
Did you see what happened on I-90, Dwight? Because what happened was the pilot car took the off-ramp, and the guy driving the truck didn't follow him.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
Yeah. The pilot, I had to go back and double-check it this morning. The pilot car took the off-ramp, which is what you do. You just drive around the overpass because you're too high. And can you imagine the horror when he looked in the rearview mirror and realized the knucklehead driving the truck was not following him off the freeway to then get back on the other side?
What is the status of that driver? Do we know?
No, we don't. And I don't know whether he ended up okay. He apparently, I mean, you've seen the pictures of the bottom end of that overpass. He hit just about every structural member. A lot of the concrete is knocked off. They're calling it $10 million. And one of the questions I want to know, though, Dwight, is typically how much insurance does a company or an individual run when they're running, an oversized load? Is it enough to pay $10 or $15 million in damages?
Well, I can't answer that, but that might fall on the pilot.
If the pilot took the off ramp and the truck driver didn't, does the pilot car have any responsibility?
Oh no, not at that point. But I can't say what the trucking company would be required to carry. I mean, you know, the possible damage can vary from, you know, a few thousand dollars to millions. So
yeah.
I don't know what the insurance coverage would have to be.
Well, you know what I think? I think if you're going to have oversized loads, maybe somebody should sit down and say, what's the most damage you could do with this truck? Oh, $20 million? Okay, you're required to carry 25. I mean, that or whatever it is, you should have to carry enough insurance to pay the freight. And if not, the company ought to pay. But I have a sneaking suspicion that the taxpayers are going to be on the hook for a big bunch of this. Dwight, thanks for the call. Back in just a moment is First Amendment Friday. This segment brought to you by 540training.com.
The Lars Larson.
Friday Night Fever.
Yes!
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
They look like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on First Amendment Friday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, which has for almost 30 years now served the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And it's a real pleasure to welcome back Pamela Fitzsimmons. She writes great pieces on Substack under the headline Portland Dissent. Pamela, welcome back.
Oh, good to be here.
You've raised the question, should a city that prioritizes ideology over public safety, think illegal alien criminals, among other issues, drugs could be another one, should they be held accountable for civic negligence? Now, before I get your first thoughts on that, do you know what just crossed my email or desk today, just 2 minutes ago, literally? A federal judge in Portland signaled Friday, this is Immergut, that she could clear the way for Oregon National Guard soldiers to come to the city, but still bar out-of-state troops for now. I don't even know how you get to a bizarre result like that where you, National Guard, except they have to have, you know, signed up for the National Guard within Oregon, but if they sign up in Washington or California or some other place, they're not allowed. But it sounds like Immergut, who's been told by the appeals court, take that stupid TRO you wrote, banning federal deployment of Oregon troops, and throw in the trash can, and she's saying, how can I weasel out of this one, I think? And, you know, I don't have to show due respect to Karen Immergut. I don't think she made a good decision to begin with. But I'm wondering what's going to happen at City Hall when they get this ruling saying, yep, they're going to deploy National Guard, and they're going to be Oregon National Guard down there at the ICE headquarters.
Well, what they did, they're trying to double down at City Council. Last week they passed something called a sanctuary ordinance, and they passed something called the Protect Portland Initiative. I will just read you the second line of the sanctuary ordinance. It says here, no matter when someone has joined our community or where they have come from, every person deserves to be free of fear and intimidation and to be treated with dignity and respect. Well, that's not going to work. Now, out at ICE, I've been out there many times, and this past week, when the initial decision came down that, hey, Trump can send the troops in, there was much anticipation among protesters and observers. You know, are they here yet? Are the troops coming? You would think that this was the storming of the beaches at Normandy. This is the humiliation of Portland, a city that cannot keep the peace on city streets in a two-block area that surrounds the ICE building, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement building. All summer long, that ICE facility has remained boarded up, and the employees have been routinely harassed every time they entered or left the building. And Portland politicians and the police chief pleaded helpless. They said there was nothing they could do. Oregon is a sanctuary state. Portland is a sanctuary city. That's an excuse. What it really means is that city police cannot enforce federal immigration laws. It doesn't mean that they can't enforce someone who is harassing, vandalizing, assaulting, or committing other crimes on city streets.
Or blocking a street, or surrounding cars and scaring the daylights. I saw one poor lady who was surrounded by that mob, and she's appealing to one of those ridiculous police liaisons, and he's saying, ma'am, there's nothing I can do about it. And you think, you're a citizen, you pay taxes, you're not getting, and when you, the only thing I'd correct, you said they can't correct it. They have chosen to let it happen. Because they could go down and say, you can stand on the sidewalk with your sign. The minute you step on private property, we'll remove you. The minute you block a street, we'll remove you. The city of Portland has said to these jokers, you can block traffic, you can harass people in cars, you can create, and I can imagine, Pamela, at some point, some poor woman or older person is going to be in a car, they're going to be surrounded, they're going to be scared to death, and they're going to say, I realized my life was in danger, and I put my foot down on the gas, and people are going to get hurt. Now, am I wishing for that? No. But I'm saying it seems inevitable that if you keep allowing and even aiding and abetting these confrontations, at some point somebody's going to reasonably say, I thought I was going to get yanked out of my car and beat to death. So I put down the gas, and did I run over some people? Yep. And was it justified? And the answer is, you're going to tell that to a jury. Should this person be able to protect themselves from a mob?
But, you know, you call this First Amendment Friday, and that's interesting because this is what the city council, our progressive leaders rely on. They use the First Amendment as a crutch to do whatever they want. They have told the protesters, you have inalienable First Amendment rights. And they have stretched those rights to include everything, including vandalism and blocking the streets and violating the noise ordinance. The neighbors near the ICE facility this past summer at 10 p.m., things didn't get quiet when the noise ordinance kicked in. Things stayed rowdy. And there were people out there who lived near there who could not sleep at night. And until Trump intervened, there were residents out there who hadn't had a peaceful night in months.
And by the way, one of the positives is just this week, San Francisco, that Trump was saying, I'm sending National Guard there next. And San Francisco apparently said, hey, we're going to get on top of this. And they've started to make some changes. And Trump said, okay, you're straightening things out to some degree. I'll hold off for now. That's how you correct behavior, isn't it?
Right. Right. That's not going to happen in Portland, I don't think. All you have to do is look at today's Oregonian. The legacy media, especially the Oregonian, have sided with the protesters. They treat the protesters as if it's all just a party. They don't understand something. There are a lot of different protesters out there, and some of them are there. Yeah, they're in frog costumes. They're out there partying, but there are other protesters out there who are very serious. And in the 2020 riots, Antifa, who are the true fascists, they promoted costumes as a way to make themselves look harmless and as a way to persuade the public that, oh, they're not doing anything. They're just exercising their First Amendment rights. It's quite a PR coup they have managed to accomplish, and the Oregonian has bought into it.
And by the way, the rest of the media, too, because, Pamela, what happens is, I'm telling you, my former profession as a TV news reporter, they've become completely idiots. They show up and they say, what's the most interesting picture? Oh, the folks in the inflatable costume. Okay, let's show those pictures. And they're aiding and abetting it instead of saying, is our job to be here not because there's an interesting, colorful parade, but because people's lives are being put at risk and a major federal institution is being harassed because it's doing its job? Should we show the fun pictures or the other ones? And unfortunately, an awful lot of the legacy TV has been saying, let's show the fun pictures because that's more interesting. And it's also stupid.
You know, the frog costume trend was started by a guy named Seth Todd. He has posted such sentiments as someone needs to bomb this administration. A bullet needs to be put in every one of Trump's cronies' heads. I got this from Andy Ngo, the Portland journalist who has been disowned by the Portland media. He now reports from London, and he knows more about what's going on in Portland than anybody at the Oregonian. He knows more about Antifa and what really goes on behind the scenes than anybody.
You're right. And Andy Ngo has been on this program all the way back to when he was a grad student at PSU, and we admire his work, and he is welcome with us any day. That's Pamela Fitzsimmons. You can find what she writes under Portland Dissent on Substack. You're listening to First Amendment Friday. I'll get to your calls and emails next.
New plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. And when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday. Glad to be with you and glad always to take your calls. Our X poll today. After this week's big gambling bust involving allegations of the mafia, members of the NBA, both current and past, Do you trust that NBA games are real, or are they rigged for the betting crowd? I would say no, I don't trust them. You can find the X-Bowl at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It is First Amendment Friday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. I want to start with Lynn. Lynn's made an interesting claim, and I'm interested to ask her a couple of questions about it. Lynn, welcome to the program on First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate this. A week ago Thursday, you were wanting to know more about Epstein.
Everybody wants to know more about what other perverts were using Jeffrey Epstein as a supplier of teenage girls for sex. What do you know?
Well, I was one of the girls. But at first, because I ran away from home, I had my own apartment. I had a job. I was a model. But then I found out that the model, the photographer was shady and wanted me to go to the schools and get other girls from junior high to come to my house. My apartment, so that they could be a model as well. And
when does Jeffrey Epstein come into this?
I was 15, and I am 60 now. So
So if I've done my math right, you're 60 now. You were 15. That was 45 years ago. I do know how to do that math. 45 years ago takes us back to 1980. Near as we can tell, right. Epstein's crimes began sometime in the 90s, and you would have been an adult by then. Have I done the math right?
Well, yeah, but it started with just innocent photography models.
Stop. You're talking about something that has nothing to do with Jeffrey Epstein, right?
Oh, yeah, it did have something to do with Epstein.
Make the connection for me. How did you ever meet Jeffrey Epstein? Did you ever meet Ghislaine Maxwell?
Yes, I did.
When did that happen?
It was in the 1991, 1990. I had ran away to hide. They found me. And
At that point, you're an adult, correct?
Right. They wanted me to get girls for them.
Okay.
And it still didn't click in my head. And when it came to me that I was actually trafficking, I panicked and freaked out.
When did it occur to you that when an adult man and an adult woman are asking you to obtain teenage girls to come with you, that this was them obtaining children for sex? It should have occurred to you the minute they said, we want you to find school age girls to come. What did you think it could be about other than that?
I thought it was all about modeling. I really did. I thought it was all about modeling. They paid my rent. They bought me a car, lavished me with gifts.
Where did all this happen?
In LA first, and then they flew me to Florida. And
have you talked to the police about this, Lynn?
I've been working on it.
You either have talked to the police or you haven't, one or the other.
No, I haven't. I'm afraid to.
Why?
I don't want to be
found. Epstein is dead. Maxwell's in prison. Everybody wants to know who the other perverts were that Jeffrey Epstein was supplying with children. So what are you afraid of?
The Clintons. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton.
Friends of Epstein, yeah.
Yes, and Hillary was the one responsible for killing Epstein. He didn't take his life.
Well, I wish I knew who killed him. I don't think he killed himself either. But do you have anything that would serve as proof of this stuff that happened over a third of a century ago?
Just what he did to me.
Okay, but you have to have some. What evidence could you offer up? I mean, Monica Lewinsky had the stained blue dress and tapes that were made by Linda Tripp. what do you have that would serve as some kind of proof that any of what you're saying is true?
I have pictures.
Pictures of you and Jeffrey Epstein?
Yes.
Okay. And you're talking to me, but you haven't called the police.
Well, the federal government has been working on it. They haven't gotten to me yet, and I'm scared to death that if I come forward, that I'm going to be, they'll make me disappear.
Well, and at some point, Lynn, you do know we're past the statute of limitations on most of this, which means that chances are they're not going to be able to prosecute anything anyway because you waited so long to come forward.
Well, so did the other girls. The other girls, they're the ones who convinced me to start talking.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do because this is going to take more time than we do on a First Amendment Friday. Leave your contact information with my producer, and I'll see what I can find out. Let's go to Mark. Hey, Mark, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling in regards to that truck driver.
The one that hit the bridge overpass and did allegedly $10 million damage? Yeah.
Right. Well, number one, I got a special license besides my CDL for 122,000 pounds.
Wow.
So basically, when he lost sight of that pilot car, which they should be communicated by CB, he's supposed to stop and pull over. No matter what the pilot car does, he's got to come around and find him again.
Yep.
Two, they're supposed to go to scale house and verify the routes that they're supposed to take.
Yep.
Even if they're not over 14'6", they could be over length. Now, as far as the insurance, I don't know if I can mention any truckers' companies' names, but a lot of trucking companies are self-insured. So many years ago, too, a trucker went over the railroad tracks and some people got killed. It wiped out that whole company. Every one of them lost.
I don't doubt it, but you know, Mark, you've hit on something. Because, for instance, what do you suppose the net worth of an entire trucking company is? Might be a lot of money, might not be very much money at all. But if you do $10 million damage, how many trucking companies do you know? I mean, they may go out of business, but then doesn't that leave the taxpayers on the hook? So if there's $10 million damage and the company goes out of business because it pays $1 million or a couple of million in damages, it leaves the taxpayers on the hook for the rest.
That is true. But that's also the guy that they're hauling the material for. They're supposed to verify what they can actually cover, especially something that's unique as that. And looking at that damage, he had to be doing well over 60 miles an hour. And he was probably distracted or listening or not paying attention. And, you know, I put all the 90% of the blame on him and the other blame on the pilot car for not yelling on the CB.
Yeah, well, although the distance from the average off-ramp to under the overpass is, what, a couple of hundred yards? I mean, at the point where the pilot car realized I've taken the ramp, but the truck that's supposed to follow me up the ramp isn't, you probably have but seconds before that truck is going to hit the overpass. Mark, thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson Show. Lars has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Wanna see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. There's a question right now. The White House says that President Trump is still the best friend of ranchers in America. And yet a lot of the ranchers, I think, are reasonably saying, yeah, but what he's doing to us right now just is not right. In the middle of all that is American consumers who've seen grocery prices go up and beef is more expensive. So the question is, should we reduce the tariffs on Argentinian beef and quadruple the amount of beef that can be brought in without tariffing? Because that'll bring down prices at the grocery store. It will also undercut the efforts of American beef producers to actually make a living. Bill Bullard joins me again. We've talked to Bill before. He's the CEO of RCAF USA, which represents a lot of those ranchers. Mr. Bullard, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Lars. Thank you.
So the White House is saying, no, Donald Trump is still one of the best friends ranchers could have, and yet I'm hearing a lot of ranchers say, yeah, but this Argentina thing is going to mess us up something fierce. Where do you fall in all that, and where does RCAF fall in all of that?
Well,
The president came out with a clear understanding of how imports depress prices in our domestic supply chains, causing our domestic industries to shrink. And that's exactly what's been happening to our domestic cattle industry over the past 40 years. We've lost over half our cattle producers in just over a generation. 106,000 of them left the industry just during the five-year period from 2017 to 2022. Yep. So the industry is shrinking at an alarming rate. President Trump said he was going to impose tariffs, and he was and with all countries, including Brazil. And we view this as a very strong indication that we had a president that was going to help the U.S. cattle industry rebuild. So this announcement about Argentina, it contradicts what the president has been doing. And we think he has been misinformed as to how damaging additional imports will be on an industry who is suffering under the weight of record imports already. And beef consumers have been paying escalating beef prices during the time we've been receiving record import volumes and during a time when cattle prices were falling. So there's a disconnect in the cattle industry between cattle prices and beef prices. Cattle producers do not set the price of retail beef. It is the packers and the retailers who are highly concentrated, who can exert tremendous buying power in the industry and leverage down the prices to producers. That's why our industry's been shrinking. So we need to rebuild the industry, and adding to the already excessive volume of imports is not going to allow our industry to rebuild, to expand, and to begin meeting America's demand for beef. So we think it's the wrong approach. We think there are solutions. The president could increase the volume of beef from Argentina if he would agree to reduce the volume of imports coming from any one of the other 19 countries that we import from in order to hold the producer harmless. Right now, the meatpackers want more imports because that increases their profit margin, and they don't have to lower the price point to consumers with these cheaper imported products because Congress had repealed the mandatory country of origin labeling law, and consumers can't distinguish between the imported product and domestic product. So if more imports come in and if consumers were to reduce their purchases of beef, well, the beef packers will simply lower the price of cattle. That would put our industry on would maintain the current downward spiral that we've been on for the past several decades.
You know, Mr. Ballard, I mean, I'll admit we had a great prime rib last weekend from my favorite local butcher, and it weighed about 15 pounds. I think that thing came in close to $300. Now, thankfully, we're feeding a big crowd of people, but this is crazy. When I went back and looked at some of the numbers a few days ago when Trump had said this on Sunday, and I'm a Trump supporter all day long, but I also tell my audience I'll mention when I disagree with the president. And when the minute I saw him say, let's bring in some cheap foreign imports and we'll lower the prices at the grocery store, I thought, I know who's going to get squeezed by that. So how do we solve this problem? And if all you say is, well, he wants to bump it up to 80,000 metric tons of beef from Argentina. It's currently 20,000 that's not subject to tariff. So he wants to quadruple that. If he does that but then reduces other foreign imports, that's not going to change the prices for the consumer, is it? So I don't think it achieves what Trump wants to do. How do we get to what right. you want to do? And I've heard people complain about the packers before. There are, what, three or four big companies that dominate the entire industry?
That's right. Four packers control over 80% of the fed cattle market. And it's by no accident that we've seen consumer groups, retailer groups, distribution groups filing beef antitrust cases, alleging beef price fixing. So that is part of this huge problem here is we've seen an inverse relationship between cattle prices going down and beef prices going up for years. And it wasn't until after these antitrust cases were filed that the cattle prices started to try to catch up with the already escalating beef prices. And very recently they have, and that's why the prices that you're experiencing exist today. And it's because the market is fundamentally broken. It's because we have allowed the meatpackers to unlimited access to cheaper imported product, not having to distinguish it in the marketplace. We have not enforced our antitrust laws. Therefore, we allow the concentrated meatpackers and retailers to leverage down domestic cattle producer prices. We've decimated our herd. So the solution for consumers is not an overnight solution. We need to rebuild our domestic cattle herd so that we can meet domestic demand, which means we will achieve national security interests of maintaining self-sufficiency in beef production. We won't do that by adding insult to injury, by adding more imports to an industry that is already suffering under the weight of imports. It's a competitive market that would provide consumers with fair, reasonable, and competitive prices. We do not have a competitive marketplace. We have a marketplace.
And just a couple of numbers I want to share, Bill, because you know the numbers better than I do. I just look them up. But when I look 50 years ago in the 1970s, America had a much smaller population. We had about 130 million head in the United States. Now we've got something like the high 80s or almost 90 million head, and we have a much bigger population. And I don't think beef has gone out of fashion. So how do we get by with two-thirds of the amount of domestic cattle? And the answer is you're importing it. Now, what seems strange to me is this is a president who rightly says we can't buy 90% of our rare earth stuff from China. We can't buy 90% of our pharmaceutical precursors from China. That's a bad situation to be in. And yet it seems that this policy is aiming us in the direction of, but when it comes to food, we're going to start buying more and more from overseas and destroying our domestic industry, which seems the opposite of all of his other policies. Am I wrong about that?
No, I agree with you that what we need to do is to establish a domestic supply chain for beef that can meet America's beef demand. And we do achieve national security there because we are then becoming less reliant on imported sources for such an important protein staple as beef. Unfortunately, we have been increasing our dependency on foreign countries for our beef, while our domestic industry has been allowed to shrink through neglect and inattention and disinterest. And suddenly we have this perfect storm where a recent drought accelerated the ongoing decline of the cattle herd numbers. We fell to the lowest level in over 70 years, extremely tight supply situation, while at the same time there's incredible beef demand. And so that's why cattle prices were able to respond and are beginning to try to catch up with beef prices. But beef prices have increased faster than cattle prices have. Since 2015, beef prices increased $2 a pound, but cattle prices only increased 40 cents per pound.
Wow.
So that's the big difference here. We have a dysfunctional market. Cattle producers are being blamed for it. It wasn't the cattle producers' fault. It was the fault of the government, who's supposed to be in charge of enforcing antitrust laws and establishing a trade policy that would not decimate our domestic industry and its supply chain. But that's
absolutely. That is Bill Bullard. Bill is the CEO of RCAF USA. Big Bill, thanks very much. Back in a moment. You're listening to First Amendment Friday.
Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails on this First Amendment Friday. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Now, our ex-poll. After last week's big gambling bust that involved allegations of gambling, the NBA, and the big mafia crime families of New York City. I mean, it had them all. Do you trust that NBA games are real, or are they rigged for the betting crowd? Now, if your impression of the story was, well, yeah, they had some big-name people from the NBA, like Chauncey Billups, who is accused in the case, not convicted, but accused. He's the Trailblazers head coach. And then, of course, you've got some players and former players. But the thing is, a separate indictment that was filed at the same time, separate from the poker indictment, detailed sports betting fraud that doesn't actually name Chauncey Billups, but describes an NBA coach that matches the description of Chauncey Billups, who passed along information about the Blazers' star players sitting out a game as the team began to tank for a top lottery pick in 2023. So It was some NBA coach who closely resembles Chauncey Billups, is what it sounds like. So, after this week's bust, do you trust that NBA games are real, or are they being rigged for the betting crowd? I don't trust them. I'm going to answer no. I don't trust that they're real at this point, and I think the league is going to have to get back people's trust. You can find the X Poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's go first to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Oh, Lars, you know, we're dragging another continent into this war. I mean, we've already got Eastern Europe and Ukraine. We've got
Africa. We have Eastern Europe and Ukraine. Donald Trump wants to get us out of Ukraine altogether, and he wants to get Ukraine and Russia to stop fighting, and he doesn't want to send any more money there or weapons there. How is that our contest?
Well, we've got Africa at war, too, which is Israel. Israel is basically Africa. So I mean,
Israel and the Middle East are north of Africa, if you know your geography. But, okay.
We have war in the Middle East. Now we're going to have war in South America.
Actually, officially a ceasefire between Gaza, which is one terrorist organization headquartered in a 5-by-25-mile chunk of land that is part of Israel, by the way. And it's not occupied. It is Israel, except they called the Gaza Strip and they handed over to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians elected a bunch of terrorists. I'm not sure what your question is or comment is.
Well, one thing all these wars have in common is ethnic cleansing. I mean, you don't have to necessarily kill a group of people to cleanse a country. You can just relocate them, which is what we're trying to do.
What ethnic cleansing is going on when there is a war between Jews who are Semites and Arabs who are Semites over a political matter between Palestinians who are not the citizens of a country because Palestine doesn't exist, and Israel, which does exist and has existed since 48? What group is being ethnically cleansed in that case?
You're trying to tell me that Hamas is Semite?
Arabs are Semites, yeah. So what?
Hamas is
a terrorist organization. If you want to talk about groups, you said it was ethnic cleansing. I'm asking you, which ethnic group is being cleansed?
They're trying to cleanse Hamas out of
Hamas
Gaza.
Is not
and
an ethnic group. Is Hamas an ethnic group?
Well, they're a military.
They're a terrorist organization, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now you said South America. What war are we in South America?
We're potentially going to go to war against the drug manufacturing
element. It's easy just to blow their supply boats out of the water. Where's the war?
Exactly. Yeah.
Where's the war?
The war is going to be taking out these fentanyl manufacturing sites that used to be super labs when it used to be methamphetamine.
Yeah, but which countries are at war in that case?
They know exactly where they are. They're in.
No,
they're
I said
Venezuela.
Which countries. You know, in World War II, you could say you had Germany, you had Japan in the Pacific, you had the United States and Russia. So which countries are involved in this South American war you're talking about?
So far, they've mentioned Colombia, they've mentioned Venezuela.
They've mentioned all kinds of countries. Which countries are you saying the United States and Donald Trump are going to war against? All he's doing is blowing illegal drug traffickers out of the water.
I'm making perfect sense. China is another country that we're going to a trade war against because they are sending.
I don't see a problem with that. China wants access to our market. They want to sell their crap in China. I would like to see that produced in America. But if we are doing trade negotiations with China, where's the war?
A trade war, a ground war, nowadays a conventional war is.
You don't see the difference between kinetic wars, as they call them, and saying we're not going to go with this trade deal if you're not going to treat the United States fair. That's the same as firing a cruise missile at somebody.
I mean, imagine going on a
no,
ground war.
No, you start answering
China.
Some of my. I've been answering your questions. I want you to answer some of mine. So is firing a cruise missile at somebody equivalent to raising a tariff on products?
No.
No, I didn't think so. And I didn't even think you would try to defend that one. But Jason, good try. And we should have actually labeled him as a naysayer. We'll give him naysayer status now. The X-Poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. It's First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
It looks like the Canadians are here.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails, but I want to put something in front of you that I think is absolutely critical. There is a conundrum, especially in the Pacific Northwest, that you have both Oregon and Washington saying, we want more business, we want more jobs, we want more housing, we want all of this. And then that very same government turns around and finds ways at various levels, state, county, and local levels, to put up blockades and prevent the very development or the very kinds of things that they say they want to have happen. And I think this one is a great example of it. A family developer being asked to pay $700,000 for roads to help other people's projects and then put the bill to the homeowners who live in the area. Brian Hodges joins me now, who's a senior attorney at Pacific Legal Foundation in the property rights practice. Brian, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Would you mind describing for my audience what COGAP Enterprises is and why this is such a perfect example of government getting in the way of good things happening?
Well, COGAP grew out of, it was a family business that originally was in logging. And when the timber business slowed down, they had a whole bunch of holdings down in the Medford area and decided to build homes. At issue in this case is Stuart Meadows, which was they call it a planned unit development, but a large development that has homes and stores and, you know, really creates a new neighborhood.
Okay, that all makes sense. Where did it go wrong?
Well, where it went wrong, you know, we all like roads. We all like to have fancy new roads. And, you know, Stuart Meadows did everything. When they built out their community, they built numerous roads, they built bridges, 6 miles of walking paths. But the city just kept coming back and asking for more. Finally, and this has been going on for 20 years, finally in 2022, the city came back. All COGAP asked for was just to move uses from one parcel to another, already approved. Everything's already been fixed up. Well, they wanted to take a road across their property in order to, because they had plans to build yet another new road to service some people who already live on what's currently a little dirt road, and future development that's to the west and south of Stuart Meadows.
Right.
But the price tag came to almost $700,000. And this is just to move a couple of pre-approved uses from one parcel to another. And it was just a road too far. COGAP stood up for its rights and said, if you want to take this from us, you're going to have to prove it this time. And that's why we're in court.
By the way, even the folks in the Medford city government are saying this may not survive a Nolan Dolan challenge. I think I remember the Dolan case, but maybe I don't. Why don't you remind my audience what that one was all about?
Yeah, Dolan, it was a case against the city of Tigard, and it followed up on, there was a...
Yeah, was it A-Boy Plumbing?
Yes, you're correct. Yes.
This is the one. Brian, let me see if my old memory can actually get this one. You've got a plumbing company that wants to build a brand new building in the city and then rebuild its old building and allow it for more retail space. And they went to the city and the city said, you will give us a piece of your property that we can use for a bike or a hiking path. And if you won't just gift it to us outright, you don't get your building permit. And it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the city government lost big time, I think at the cost of more than $1 million. Do I have it pretty close?
You have it very close, A plus. But that's exactly what continues to go on. I mean, what happened in Dolan was the city said that, you know, we can take this bike path from you, this walking and bike path, because when you build a nicer store, more people are going to come, they'll shop there, and so it'll increase traffic. And they said, well, people bike, people walk, that's transportation. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no. If you're going to take somebody's property for free as a condition on a permit, you have to show us more. You have to actually do your homework and say, are these bicyclists actually going to be shopping at a hardware store? You know, is this exaction, they call it an exaction, this exaction of property, well, really related to this revised hardware store?
And Brian, doesn't this come down to what all of us, even us non-lawyers like me and like most of my audience, would say, yeah, wasn't there something about no man or woman's life, liberty, or property may be taken without just compensation and due process? So you want to take my property, yeah, you've got to compensate me. And the city of Taggart said, screw you, Dolan, or A-boy. We're just going to take your property, and we'll act like the trolls under the bridge saying, we have, you know, if you want to go buy here, you have to pay, and you have nothing to say about it. That's basically what they told them, right?
Yeah, I mean, and in even more certain terms, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court referred to it as an out-and-out plan of extortion, because to use your property, you have to get permission from the government. So you're over the barrel when you go in, because, you know, they can say no, and then you can't use your property. It's essentially valueless. So you're in a position where they can nickel and dime you. And oftentimes people will just give, you know, until it hurts so much that they have to fight.
Do these cities, Medford, Tigard, whoever it is, do they understand that this is blocking the very things they're begging for? They're saying, we want more business, we want more housing, would somebody please build it? And then when people try to do it, like COGAP, the cities turn around and say, well, now that we've got you over a barrel and you folks are going to make some money on this and you want to use your property, we're going to stand there like an extortionist and say, you either pay, like dealing with the mob in Chicago 100 years ago, you either pay or nothing happens. You don't get to use your property. That's what they're doing.
Yeah, and boy, I mean, I hope that they understand that, you know, taking from the developer means that they're actually taking from the future home buyer.
Yep.
Because those costs, it becomes a cost of a new home. There was a case recently out of North Carolina where the court recognized this is going to increase the cost of homes. And, you know, once that happens, it just, if the government can keep going back and asking for more and more, it just adds to what's already a skyrocketing home price.
Yeah. Well, when does this one go to court?
Well, it went to court yesterday. Argued it at the Ninth Circuit.
Well, the circus court has been pretty good lately. I like their decision on the National Guard. When do you get to hear a decision?
Well, it's not the fastest court. I expect within a year, hopefully, we'll hear a decision. Arguments went well. The city had very little evidence to show that this demand was sufficiently related to COGAP's request to move a couple of users.
No, they don't have to worry. When you're the extortionist, you don't have to explain why you're extorting. You just do the extortion. That's Brian Hodges from Pacific Legal.
Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on First Amendment Friday. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. I want to mention one story about EBT and food stamps. Now, ordinarily, I'm one of the people who complains when people use food stamps for something other than the purpose for which they are, and which is SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's supposed to supplement your food budget. But then I saw this story out of Michigan, and it's about a woman who is now looking at 10 years in prison for selling baked goods. I'm not kidding. And ordinarily, you might say, well, Lars, if that woman was not using the food stamps the way she was supposed to, then you would want her punished. Because when people commit food stamp fraud, where they go out and they sell their food stamps or SNAP benefits for 75 or 50 cents on the dollar, you're right. I object to that. You know what this woman was doing? 32-year-old woman was using her EBT program to buy baking ingredients, which she then took home to make homemade goods that she sold online for about a year. And she did a year and a half, from January of 22 to September of 23, and she used what she made from the baked goods to support her family. In other words, she was adding value. Now, you might say, no, she should have just taken that EBT to the grocery store, bought groceries, and supported her family that way. Can you imagine what an entrepreneur you have to be to say, if I take my EBT card and go to the grocery store and just buy food for my family, I might have $500. But if I go down and I buy a few hundred dollars worth of baking ingredients and then I add value to it, I put my time and effort into it, I make baked goods, I sell them online, maybe I'll end up with $800 to support my family. I am better off. Isn't that the point of the program? To supplement your nutrition. If she ends up with more money to spend on groceries because she added value. The Food Stamp Act of 1977, so it's been around for almost 50 years, bans using government food benefits for resale or business. Now, I think in most cases, that's the person who goes down and finds a way to buy, say, energy drinks with your EBT and then resell the energy drinks directly. But this woman is actually adding value. According to the court documents, the prosecutors say this woman made several thousand dollars in sales. That meant that she had committed a baking felony since the amount exceeded $1,000. If convicted, she faces not only a decade behind bars, but a potential $250,000 fine. She is now out on a personal bond, and her case continues to go through the Michigan courts. I got to tell you something. If somebody figures out a way to take their SNAP benefits and not just sell them at some kind of discount, or the idiots who go in and they buy, say, bottled water in a state that has a bottle deposit, and then they dump the water on the ground, take the bottles back in, and turn it into cash so that they can then take the cash and spend it on booze or cigarettes or heroin or fentanyl or whatever. That's one thing. This woman goes down, buys some baking powder, buys some flour, buys some yeast, goes out, makes some products, sells them online, enhances her family's food budget. I frankly don't see the problem. On that note, since it's First Amendment Friday, let me go to Stumpy. Hey, Stumpy, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, I got a question.
Okay.
The Democrats and the Republicans don't like to work together. So you got like two seats. If you change that from two seats, you know, like let's just say you got 150 Republicans, 50 Democrats, why not go 33 independents, 33 Republicans, 33 Democrats, and then you're gonna, then they have to work together. It's just an idea.
No, they don't. And Stumpy, I've had so many people suggest we should have more political parties. And I've said, if you think this is chaos right now, here's why it becomes even more chaotic. Stumpy, you're going to go meet with two of your friends, and then you're going to go to lunch, right? So there are three people there, and one guy says, I want hamburgers. And one person says, I want to have breakfast for lunch, which is that's actually one of my favorites, is you know, eggs and, you know, all the rest of that for lunch. And somebody else says, I want pizza. What's the compromise? How do you get them to agree on a place to go have lunch?
I guess it's going to be like 2 out of 3.
Yeah, 2 out of 3 are going to have to get together. So the guy who wants pizza gets together with the guy who wants hamburgers, says, okay, I'll compromise. Now, imagine this in political terms. I'm imagining your three parties. So you have one person who says, I am pro-gun and pro-life. And somebody else says, well, I'm anti-gun and I'm anti-life. And the third person is pro-life or pro-abortion and pro-gun. Now, how do you get any two of those in the same, you know, in the same category? Because to make decisions, you have to have a majority. And if you want the worst example of this, the state of Israel has about a dozen major parties, and they have another dozen or so minor parties. And this is why their Congress, their Knesset, always has a tough time making decisions. Because on Capitol Hill, whichever party has the majority becomes the controlling party of the House or the Senate, or in the case of this year, both. The Republicans control. That's who appoints the committee chairs. That's who has the majority when something comes up for a vote. If all the Republicans vote for it and all the Democrats vote against it, and it's an ordinary majority vote, the Republicans are going to win. Same thing happens in reverse when the Democrats have a majority, which they do, sadly, from time to time. If you had three parties, how do you make a decision in Congress?
Well, they would have to work together, but I'm seeing what you're saying.
No, but they don't have to work together, and that's why Israel's government is constantly flying apart. Because imagine, say you had 4 or 5 or 6 parties. One is pro-energy, one is anti-fossil fuels, so they're opposed. Then one is pro-this, and the other one's anti-this. At that point, you have to form a coalition where a bunch of people who ordinarily hate that person's position are all going to agree to cooperate for about 10 seconds. And then it all comes apart at the seams. You see why?
So more is worse.
More is worse because at the end of the day, Stumpy, every decision in life, and tell me if I'm wrong, and I know there are people who say you're too black and white. I don't care. That's the way life is. Are we going to go to dinner or not? And you say, well, what if there's a third or fourth option? Should we turn the light switch on or off? Should we do this project or not? Almost everything in life comes down to binary decisions. It's yes, it's no. It's one, it's zero. And the minute you say, oh, let's have 5 options or 5 people who all are in favor of something different, to be able to get to a decision out of those 5, you need 3 to all be in favor of something and only 2 against it to make decisions. And I'm telling you something, when you have, that's why most bodies like school boards are made up of an odd number. You ever notice that? It's 5 members, 7 members, 9 members. Why? Because if you have an even number, you know what you get when 4 people vote for something and 4 people vote against it? You get no decision at all. And as the great rock band Rush said, if you decide not to decide, you still have made a choice. And you're listening to First Amendment Friday on The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's new. What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
It's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. One of the things I endeavor to do for you, and I try to do it for myself, is understand what the heck all the numbers mean. So when you hear new numbers about the Consumer Price Index, and now the All Urban Consumers Price Index, and all the other numbers that are thrown around, we got to turn to people like Stephen Cates, who's a certified financial planner and a financial analyst at Bankrate, and see if he can get us on the right track. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things that frustrated me this morning was I said, well, here's the inflation rate. And as the piece I was reading said, compared to last year at this time. And I thought, well, last year at this time was kind of, that's apples and oranges, or Trump and President Otto Penn, if you will. you'll forgive me for doing that. Is there any business comparing this year's inflation rate to what was going on under Joe Biden, and where are we really headed with the CPI right now?
Well, so it is important to look at, you know, a year-over-year inflation rate, which you can extrapolate by looking at, you know, what were the price levels back in September of 24 versus September of 2025, this month, right, that we just got the report on. And that shows us how are we seeing these prices move over time, because the monthly numbers are kind of hard to conceptualize, and, you know, they move around a lot. You know, if you look at a month-to-month basis and you say, okay, great, you know, August to September price increase was 0.31%, and we expected 0.38%. Does that mean anything to you? For most people, it doesn't. But when we think about, okay, we have 3% annual inflation, prices have risen on average 3% from last year to today, that is a little bit more meaningful and just makes a little bit more sense to everybody. And that's what we have. So we did see prices move from August, September, from a rate of about 2.94% to a rate of about 3.03%. So it's increasing. It's increasing at a slower rate than it has been in the past few months, but it's still increasing and is still likely to keep increasing for the next few months. And that is going the opposite direction of what we want.
Okay, and the other number that I always hear about is the producer price index. So this is, as I understand it, what the folks who make the stuff that I want to buy, it's not the prices or how much the price of the things I want to buy have gone up. It's how much the price that's paid by the people who make the stuff I want to buy has gone up or not. Is there any good news there?
Well, so we don't have that data. Because of the government shutdown, we only have the CPI report. And this report stands out because the only reason we got it is because it's legally required to calculate the Social Security cost of living adjustment by November 1st. And so this CPI report is a bit of a, you know, an orphan report, because the BLS had to do this for Social Security. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten it. And we won't get another CPI report if the government continues to remain shut down.
Well, my bet is they're not going to go past the 35 days that's the historic benchmark for government shutdowns. Although, I don't know, maybe the Democrats will keep it going. But what else do we know? What about the other factors that go into what causes prices to go up or down? I mean, we've got an administration now that says we're going to roll back regulations as much as we can. We're going to increase the supply of energy and hopefully bring the price down. We've got gasoline headed below $3 a gallon for the first time in, I think, 3 or 4 years. And we've got other things that are dropping down a bit as well, including mortgage costs and things like that. If you take all those different data points and put them together, is this small increase, but still an increase, does it suggest that we're going to start ticking back up again, or that it's just a blip?
So I think that this is, you know, on a month-over-month basis, we've got prices that move around quite a bit. Like gasoline in September was up 4% for just the month, which is a big move, but it's a relatively volatile price. It does have those kind of moves, and that isn't likely to happen every month, but it can. Overall, in the last year, gasoline prices are down 0.5%. So, you know, a little bit of movement month to month doesn't make a whole lot of difference.
Right.
Things like durable goods prices, services, which includes medical services, you know, car repairs, then there's, you know, the shelter, which is owner equivalent rent, how much you could, you know, rent your home for, or actual rental prices. All of those things are much more meaningful to what people are seeing on a day-to-day, you know, in their day-to-day life, and food prices goes along with that. Those are still rising, but some of them are rising at a much lower rate than they were a few months ago, and that's a good thing. So although we have inflation that is going up, it seems to be going up at a slower pace, so we're probably getting to the point where we're going to sort of hit the peak inflation, and we'll probably remain somewhere in the low threes for a little while before it starts coming down.
And the ideal is supposed to be around 2. Am I right? That's what the Fed, I don't like the Fed, but that's what they're shooting for.
That's what they're aiming for, yeah. I mean, the benchmark that they want is about 2%. So we're about 50% higher than that. But, you know, they've made it relatively clear that they feel like the labor market is the bigger risk right now. And so given this softer than expected CPI report. I think it's pretty much cements that they're going to cut rates again next week.
Okay, let me ask you about something else, and that has to do with healthcare in particular, but let me use a different comparison. There were all these colleges that kept jacking up their tuition rates. And then I saw that they came out and said, hey, you know what? We're going to cap those student loans at 50 grand. And all of a sudden, I think it was Claremont said, hey, we were charging 60. We're going to go back to 50. In other words, they said, we're going to go back to the maximum amount our students can borrow, which was 60, and now it's 50, and they dropped it down. Now, I'm not saying health insurance or health care necessarily does that, but when we see the Republicans saying, we're not going to put all those COVID-era Obamacare expansion nonsense, we're not continuing that, even though the Democrats are demanding it, depending on how that fight comes out, if they're not pumping more money into that system, then the system has to adjust to the new monetary reality at some point. Am I wrong in looking at it that way?
If you look at it from a supply and demand perspective,
yeah,
then no, I wouldn't say that that's wrong at all. You know, ultimately, you know, as money floods into a market, that can increase prices when there is, you know, only so much supply of those services or those goods, whatever you're talking about, you know, with a capped supply and increasing demand, you're going to get rising prices. And that certainly applies to colleges. It can certainly apply to medical care. It can apply just about everything else. You know, that's kind of the Econ 101. And obviously there's more complexity to that when you dig into a system, certainly the medical system, which couldn't be more complex. But, you know, on a high level, you know, more money into a cap supply is going to increase prices.
And in general, into the economy, when Trump says, look, we're going to cancel all this Green New Deal garbage, and they're clawing back as many billions as they possibly can, that's another monetary input that was there that now to some extent is going to be pulled back. I mean, maybe not 100%. I know the Democrats are going to court to sue the government and say, you have to give us the solar panel money. Why, we were expecting it. Well, if it actually gets clawed back, that's some more of that cash that was flowing into the economy that won't be flowing into the economy artificially from the government, right?
Well, yeah, I think that, I mean, if you've got a lot of money coming in from the government, it's going to spur companies to, you know, to try to supply and pop up and do that. I think to a certain extent, you know, government intervention can have some benefits of guaranteeing some level of production. You know, we're certainly seeing that from, you know, infrastructure around, you know, chips and semiconductors. The government's now taking stakes in some of these important categories and important companies. And, you know, that has a benefit to doing what, you know, the free market not necessarily can do, which is to tell, you know, IBM, we're going to support your foundry and we're going to incentivize you to keep working and to, you know, become, you know, a bigger player in the semiconductor market. That can be beneficial. That's certainly something that the government can do, but a company itself or the market itself not necessarily can do.
I'd rather see the private equity get in there, but that's Stephen Cates. He's a certified financial planner and financial analyst at Bankrate. Stephen, thank you very much. Back in a moment. It's First Amendment Friday. Your phone calls are welcome, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, apparently I wasn't the only one who liked that story out of Michigan where the lady took her EBT benefits, made baked goods, then sold the baked goods online to have even more money to support her family. Now she's looking at 10 years in prison. And Cindy Garricky writes in, Lars, so if you abuse government assistance, the government traditionally looks the other way. But if you use the government assistance to get off of assistance, you're going to be prosecuted. Sounds like liberal ideology to me. Signed, Cindy. And I think Cindy's absolutely right. We love naysayers on this program, have for more than 25 years. So Chris is just such a naysayer. Chris, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer on this First Amendment Friday?
Selling of beef. I sell beef on the hoof and by the package pound. One of the problems is the USDA. They're absolute buffoons when it comes to the facilities and the actual inspectors and whatnot. So, like, getting animals knocked in the head is a real problem. So that brings the beef price up. As far as the import situation, my wife and I, we disagree on this as well, that I am for bringing cattle into this nation from other places just to kind of equalize the price a little bit. But, like, right now we're making as much as we ever have on the hoof. I mean,
right now.
Right now. And I understand that, like, we're trying to make up for previous years that weren't as good, but there's a lot of factors a lot of people don't see. One of my proposals is we need to bring more beef into this country. What I would like to see is probably bring in heifers so it brings our supply of producers up instead of necessarily bringing in animals for slaughter. Let's bring in some high quality animals from other countries.
Except when they talk about 80,000 metric tons out of Argentina, they're not talking about animals on the hoof, are they? Aren't they talking about either already slaughtered or will be the minute they get here, which undercuts your business?
I understand. I agree. I see what you're saying there, and it's a valid point. But at the same time, my solution would be to, instead of bringing in, you know, I don't mind bringing in temporarily some beef to bring the price down for the consumers, because, you know, we need to get the prices down because we want to reelect Donald Trump.
He's not going to run for office again because the Constitution says he can't. Although I think at this point he might get reelected.
Okay. I agree 100%. But
Tell me what happens. We bring in cheap Argentine beef. We quadruple the amount. It brings the prices down. Then when you go to market to sell your beef, people say, we're not going to pay as much. And all of a sudden, your business here in America becomes unprofitable. So you say, okay, heck with it. I'll just slaughter my whole herd, cash out, and I'll get out of the business, which apparently a lot of people have already been doing for years. Yeah, but do we want to reverse that? Do you want to reverse that and say we want more beef producers in America and we want to produce the vast majority of what America needs? And then if we import some because you've got Wagyu or something that's, you know, special stuff. But if you undercut the domestic producers, don't they just go away?
Yeah, you're right. But with the prices so high as it is, we've been culling our herd cows that we would rebreed. We're like, well, let's call this one because their prices have been so good, so it's been bringing the numbers down because we've been calling them out early compared to what we normally would because the prices have been so good. So I mean, you know,
I'm hearing about it from my neighbors who are saying, look, you can get $4,000 for a calf, and you're like, what? I say, you get $4,000.
I've seen day old calves go for $1,000, but never.
No, I'm talking about ones that are maybe ready for, close to ready for market. But they're just bragging on. Yeah, I took some cows in $2,500, $3,000 a piece. You're right. They're getting good numbers. The problem is when they sell those and they get slaughtered, then what happens next year? Because I worry about America getting into that spot where now all we can afford to buy is the cheap import, which is how I think we got in the position we're in with China and rare earths, or China and pharmaceutical precursors. Why doesn't anybody in America make all those stuff we make prescription drugs out of? Well, because the stuff from China was cheaper. So now we buy 90% of it from China, and we have almost no domestic production at all. And when you say, well, how long would it take for us to rebuild that industry? A couple decades.
And I agree with you. I agree with you 100% here. But that's why my solution is to import young heifers, good quality heifers, to bring the stock. Because people can't even get into the beef industry anymore when you're trying to buy, you know, calves that are day old for $1,000. I've seen that, you know, at local auctions, you know. And, like, you know, right now, like Toppenish or Moses Lake, the animals are going for, you know, 600 pound six weight steers or you know, $1.60, $1.65. You know, heifers are like $1.40 a pound.
Yeah. And when you, know, you get like, to it, when you started $1,000, and I say, Chris, hang on to it all winter, and you say, well, that cow calf's going to cost me a ton of hay a month for 3 or 4 months, so there's another $1,200. And even if you do your own vet work, by the time you get to market, you say, wow, I got $2,800 for this calf that I bought for $1,000 and put $1,500 into it. Wow, I made $300.
There's no margin.
No, well, or yeah, you get $300. Well, do that 100 times, Chris. Have a herd of 100. You go, wow, I made $30,000. I made almost as much as the kid who's flipping burgers down at Burgerville. You know, that doesn't work. But Chris, you're a good naysayer. Thanks for the call. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.